Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and it's Saturday. Time to go into the vault for an older episode of the show. This one originally aired on February 8th, 2022. It's part three of our series about thirst. Let's jump right in.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and we're back with part three of our series on the question of thirst. Now, if you remember in the last episode, Rob, we talked about the biology of thirst anticipation of the quenching of thirst, because there's this interesting thing where, you know, after you drink a glass of water when you've been dehydrated, it takes some number of minutes, maybe on the order of tens of minutes, before that water actually gets absorbed through the digestive system and ends up in the blood and makes a difference systemically throughout the body. Mm-hmm. And yet you still feel that thirst quenchiness after you have just the first glass of water. You're not continuously chugging for 10 to 20 minutes, at least hopefully not. But to start off today, I wanted to come back to the question of how it is that the body detects and anticipates the coming changes in your blood, in your blood osmolality, which again is the concentration of dissolved substances like mineral salts in your body's water content, and how it anticipates those changes to provide you that delicious feeling of having your thirst quenched by a glass of water. Now, in the previous episodes, we already talked about a few ways that the mouth and the throat might detect the introduction of water into the body and sort of send signals to the brain saying, hey, okay, you can put the thirst on hold for now. There are soon coming changes to the body's hydration levels. And one of the ideas we talked about was the possibility that temperature plays a role, because maybe there's some evidence that the power of water to cool the mouth and throat sends quenching signals to the brain. And also, there was some evidence that rodents were using sour taste receptors in the mouth to detect the presence of water. But Rob, maybe you can set me straight on this one. I don't think it was clear that triggering these sour taste receptors actually led to the quenching of thirst. Rather, it seemed to encourage more drinking behavior when the mouse was thirsty. Is that right?
Yes, that's my understanding of these findings.
But I was actually reading about a few more studies on exactly this question of how thirst quenching happens. What is the mechanism that leads to these changes in the brain that tell you, aha, thou art now quenched? So the first thing I wanted to talk about was a study that I was reading about in a New York Times article from 2018 by Veronique Greenwood, called You Get Thirsty and Drink, How Does Your Brain Signal You've Had Enough? And this is referring to a paper that I think came up in passing in the previous episode, but it was by Vineet Augustine et al. In Nature in 2018 called Hierarchical Neural Architecture Underlying Thirst Regulation. And this research has been looking at exactly this question we just brought up, and they confirmed that, of course, there is a complex of neurons in the brain that appear to cease activity after a thirsty mouse drinks water. So there are some neurons that are apparently signaling that, generating that thirst motivation state, but then when a rodent takes some water in through the mouth, those neurons shut up. They go quiet. So this would be the neural mechanism to register quenching, but the question is, what is the direct mechanism that leads to the changes in those neurons? Now, this New York Times article summarizes the findings as explained by the first author on that paper, Vineet Augustine. Quote, "Intriguingly, what these cells are responding to is not the presence of water itself," Mr. Augustine said. "The researchers discovered that letting a mouse take big gulps of water would spur the neurons into action, but giving it water in gel form, which had to be chewed before it could be swallowed, did not. Neither did providing water in tiny 2-second-long sips, even when the animals consumed the same total amount of water. In fact, giving the mice oil to drink had just the same effect on the neurons as gulping water." So that last part is a little gross, but based on this finding, it would kind of imply that a major mechanism leading these thirst neurons to say, okay, thirst has been quenched, would have something to do with like muscular movements in the throat, the kind of gulping that you do when you're guzzling down a bunch of water really fast. But technically, maybe it doesn't even have to be water. It's just any fluid that you're gulping.
I mean, as humans, we don't, I guess, drink a lot of just straight oil, but we do drink a lot of things that are to varying degrees removed from just a neutral water. So this would make sense.
Right. But if you hydrate yourself in some other way, so like the examples they use, say consuming water in gel form where you can't like gulp it down really, mm-hmm. that still hydrates you, but that apparently does not lead to this immediate quenching signal in the brain. Similarly with drinking water in very small isolated sips, I guess in those cases you would eventually hydrate yourself. And your thirst will eventually go away, but it will be more likely that your body has to just become systemically hydrated before the thirst goes away. It's not that sudden quenching reward feeling. Mm. Now, there was an interesting detail offered here about reasons that the body might need to have this reaction where we turn off thirst very quickly after getting a drink. Like, why not just wait for your blood osmolality to reach the ideal level? Well, in previous episodes, we talked about one reason for this, which is that, you know, if you actually did have to wait for your body's water content to get all leveled out right before your thirst went away, you might like kill yourself drinking gallons and gallons of water because, you know, over the course of the tens of minutes that it takes for this change to take hold. Mm-hmm. But there's another reason one of the authors of this paper brings up that's in this Greenwood article in the Times, quote, "Aside from the specter of water intoxication, there are good reasons to drink only the minimum amount necessary. When an animal lowers its head to drink," Dr. Oka speculated, and that's Dr. Yuki Oka, "it's in quite a vulnerable position. Quote, if you double the time of ingestion, that should double the risk of being prey," he said. And I thought that was interesting, too. I mean, I think it is true that in the natural environment, as we brought up in the previous episode, going for water is often putting yourself in a vulnerable position, you know, maybe exposing yourself from hiding or shelter and sort of turning your attention away from scanning your surroundings.
Yeah. I mean, in many cases, too, the access point to the water might not provide much in the way of cover for smaller animals. And then for larger animals, there may be bodily positions they have to get into to drink that put them in a greater state of vulnerability. Like I'm thinking of a giraffe, for instance. Though a giraffe, of course, is a pretty formidable animal, but still, there's a certain awkwardness present when it actually has to drink water.
Sorry, I just started thinking about gamer fuel.
Yeah, this says I have no research to back this up. This is just observational material for me. But I think everyone knows that I enjoy watching the squirrels. And we have a bird bath outside near our feeders. And the bird bath is positioned right up against the fence. And the squirrels drink from that all the time. But I wonder how much of that is that they're able to drink from the bird bath while essentially remaining in a vertical position attached to the fence. Like they don't have to, go across a clearing. They have, I guess, pretty good cover for a squirrel. Though squirrels are bold in other ways that, make you think that they're less concerned or they're in control of the situation as far as potential predators go.
So if you happen to have sitter squirrels and rover squirrels, your bird bath is positioned in such a way that even the sitter squirrels could get to it.
I guess so. But then, I don't know. I'd be interested to hear what anyone else out there has observed with their squirrels and drinking water from bird baths and other water sources. Do they seem to like one thing versus the other? I don't know. They certainly drink more water than my cat. I'll give them that.
Hmm. Well, anyway, there was another article from the very next year, also in the New York Times, also by Greenwood, covering follow-up research from some of the same scientists. So this was published May 31st, 2019, just called The Neurobiology of Thirst. And this is summarizing a study published in 2019 in the journal Neuron, where the authors, the first author on this one was Vineet Augustine, and it was called Temporally and Spatially Distinct Thirst Satiation Signals. And the authors here found that the pleasure we get from drinking when thirsty is, once again, not directly related to hydration. It is a reward pathway separated by both time and space from the body's hydration and osmolality monitoring mechanisms. And one of the major findings in this paper is that though drinking water is associated with a dopamine release, this is a typical signal that the brain is expecting a reward, right? Things that you want to get and feel good when you get them. That involves a dopamine release. But the feeling of reward in the brain here is apparently not tied to becoming hydrated after being dehydrated, but specifically to the act of drinking water through the mouth. So if you're dehydrated and then you suddenly receive water through an IV or even via a direct injection into the stomach, your thirst will eventually go away after your body adjusts to the new fluid levels, but you won't get that feeling of reward satisfaction or the corresponding dopamine release. Those come specifically from the activity of drinking, the gulping of water through the mouth. And picking up on this, I was actually looking at one more paper that had an interesting finding I wanted to mention. This other one was a little earlier. This was from 2016, published in Nature, called Thirst Neurons Anticipate the Homeostatic Consequences of Eating and Drinking. And this is by Zimmerman et al. And this study found, among other things, a dual-track monitoring system for thirst management. So along the lines we've already been talking about, it found that if you take mice and you give them some salt and make them thirsty, drinking water rapidly inhibits neurons in a region of the brain called the subfornical organ, or SFO, and that leads to thirst quenching. And of course, this is before there is any notable change in blood osmolality. But it also found that if you take these thirsty mice and you give them very salty water and the opportunity to drink it, they will drink it, and initially they will gulp it down, and it will inhibit the SFO neurons and apparently quench thirst just like the fresh water. But the quenching doesn't last for very long. And they write, quote, "This initial decline was reversed after approximately 1 minute. This indicates that the rapid anticipatory response to drinking has at least two components, an immediate signal that tracks fluid ingestion and a delayed signal that reports on fluid tonicity, possibly generated by an esophageal or gastric osmosensor." So if you put all of this together, it seems like you've got at least three different time-dependent levels of sort of the body's quench watch. So you put them all together and you've got one system that's like, are you gulping fluid? If you are, oh, that's very good. Very good. Thou art quenched. But then there's a second system on a slight delay from that one, roughly 1 minute of delay in mice. It's like, wait a second. what exactly was that you were just gulping? Was that oil or was that super salty water? You know, what are you trying to pull? And if it was, if it was not good fresh water, then it will cancel the quench and return the thirst. And then finally, I guess there's just the direct blood volume and osmolality monitoring, which is on a much greater delay than the other two.
So first of all, reminder, if anyone's interested in the whole drinking saltwater thing, we did a whole episode on drinking saltwater a while back. Yeah. But you should be able to find that in the archives.
Not a good idea was one of the main findings there.
but the other thing I think, and we've kind of touched on this a little bit already, but you know, it would be a mistake to think of like, okay, it's just, you know, what's drinking water? Water in, water out. You know, even if you then acknowledge, okay, well, you know, the levels have to be just right, but it's more than that. It's not like organisms just one day were like, hey, there's water, we can drink that, we should use this to our advantage. No, like, we are of water. So right. It's like water in, am water, evolved out of things in water, et cetera. So it makes sense that there would be a more complex relationship with multiple triggers that, you know, that we're still trying to understand.
Yeah. I mean, as we said at the very beginning, you are the direct descendant of creatures that long ago lived in the ocean, and all of your ancestors, just like you, brought the ocean with you onto land. The ocean is now inside your skin.
Yes.
Oh, and before I wrap up, this last study I mentioned also documents interesting evidence for the oral cooling mechanism of thirst quenching that I brought up in the previous episode. So the authors here say that, quote, we found that applying cold but not room temperature metal to the oral cavity of awake, thirsty mice was sufficient to rapidly inhibit SFO neurons. Thus, temperature-dependent modulation of SFO neurons may explain the enigmatic connection between oral cooling and thirst, including why thirsty rodents will avidly lick cold metal, and humans report that sucking on ice chips rapidly relieves thirst.
Hmm. That's interesting. I hadn't really thought about that with sucking on ice chips, though. Though obviously, I mean, I think that's something we all do if we have access to iced drinks. Though, of course, the thing with ice, of course, is that ice melts in your mouth as well and actually serves to hydrate you.
Right, but that the cooling effect of having the ice in the mouth may provide a level of thirst-quenching sensation that goes beyond the actual amount of water you're taking in from that ice.
This gives me a great idea. Showrunners and so forth of The Witcher, if you're listening, I would love to see a scene where Henry Cavill's Witcher character shares some wisdom, and he's like, sometimes when I'm thirsty, I just have a good lick of my sword, takes care of it. You know, that'd be great. You have a scene there where he's just kind of licking his the blade of his sword.
I'd never heard this before, that apparently thirsty rodents will lick cold metal, but
yeah, I had not sense. Either. Yeah, but and if it's good enough for mice, it's good enough for The Witcher.
I think old Geralt's just gonna. That's how you cut your tongue, buddy. That's how you cut your tongue.
Oh, you know, it reminds me of Bram Stoker's Dracula. We have that wonderful scene where Gary Oldman's elderly Dracula licks the blood from the straight razor.
Ugh, yeah.
See, he was thirsty, and he quenched the thirst, but also, hopefully, the blade was cold enough that that also had an effect on him.
Well, I guess after all these studies we looked at on the quenching mechanism, I'm wondering, so two main different ones have emerged. One is the oral cooling mechanism, and the other is the gulping mechanism, you know, the muscular movements in the throat as you're swallowing large amounts of water. And I guess I'm not sure if these two different explanations are competing or if they're complementary. Maybe they both play a role in regulating these thirst neurons in the SFO. I'm not sure.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours.
Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Eugene Fodor!
Gene, was booted!
Much of the joy you will find on the road comes from the person you share it with.
So you write the books, Gene. Vlastar on the business. I understand now. It's a wise man who marries a wiser woman.
But be careful and choose your travel partner well, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
Get down!
I'm not stupid, Jean. Something is going on, and it's high time you tell me the truth.
Freeze, Americano! Huh? Oh!
Jean, run!
So travel before it's too late. Your money will return. Your time won't. And we're all too quickly approaching that final destination.
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, given all the things we've discussed about the complexity of thirst sensations and water acquisition by various organisms, I thought it might be interesting to look at a couple of examples that in different ways seem to hijack mechanisms of related to thirst and our relationship with water, well, not only ours, but also some other organisms, for the benefit of a life form. Not the life form that is potentially thirsty, but a life form that is hijacking that organism, such as a parasite or a virus.
Oh, interesting.
So the first one I want to mention here is one that definitely affects humans, and that is rabies. Now, I think everyone has heard of rabies. If not, buckle in, because I'm going to share a little bit. Though this is obviously a topic that we could really bust out if we wanted to and give a full episode treatment. But even if you're just vaguely familiar with rabies, you might not grasp the full danger and horror of this particular zoonotic viral disease.
I think a while back I've read at least somebody making the case that rabies is a contender for like the worst disease known.
Yeah, it is pretty horrifying. And for a lot of people in the world, particularly in, let's say, the United States, you're lucky enough to live largely removed from it. I think that the U.S. is sometimes classified as being free of canine rabies. Now, there are still cases of canine rabies that pop up, and there are deaths that occur, but not at the same rate as other parts of the world where the problem has not been contained as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it's rabies is caused by the virus Lysavirus, which essentially means rage poison. It's named for the Greek goddess Lysa, the goddess of rage, fury, and rabies, The daughter of Nyx, sprung from the blood of Uranus. And she pops up in different tales, like, for instance, at the urging of Hera, she inflicts madness on Heracles. And in some tellings, she's also involved in the punishment of the hunter Actaeon, who's torn apart by his own mad hunting dogs. And in Memory Serves, there are some interesting treatments of this this latter tale in art.
Yeah.
I think he looked at a god or something to that effect. You know, you don't have to do much to get torn apart by dogs when you're dealing with the Greek pantheon.
Yeah, I don't remember all the details, but I think he makes Artemis angry for some reason, and then he's a hunter, but then he's transformed into the quarry, like he's transformed into a stag or something, and then his own hunting dogs hunt
That's
him.
That's right. There's some transformation involved there as well. So humans have been exposed to rabies for a very long time. It's thought that it probably originated in old world bats and especially flourished during the heyday of dog domestication. So it is it is definitely tied to the canine world.
Mm-hmm.
According to The History of Rabies in the Western Hemisphere by Velasco Villa et al., published in Antiviral Research, the earliest record of a disease affecting humans that's consistent with rabies and associated with dogs is found in the Eshnunna cuneiform law tablets in ancient Mesopotamia, dating back to the 18th through 19th centuries BCE.
Wow.
Yeah, and I believe, if memory served, it concerns like laws concerning dogs biting people, like if you have a dog and it bites somebody.
Hmm.
And of course, we have other references to either cases that seem like they could be rabies or we feel pretty strongly are referring to rabies. Aristotle seemed to have wrote of it in 330 BCE, quote, "Dogs suffer from the madness. This causes them to become very irritable, and all animals they bite become diseased." Democritus and Hippocrates also wrote of it as well, and there are comparisons to raging dogs in the Iliad that it seems like maybe you're less certain that this is referring, because, of course, a dog can rage, I guess. It doesn't have to be rabid. But there are also mentions of the dog star Orion exerting a malignant influence on human health.
Mm.
And rabies is just a terrible disease, especially when you really get into what it can do to an organism and what it can do to a human being. Today, it's vaccine preventable, and the vaccines keep improving. But once clinical symptoms appear, it is 100% fatal. According to the World Health Organization, in 99% of cases, domestic dogs are responsible for spreading it to humans. Again, in the United States, it is effectively, we're effectively canine rabies free, though you will still find cases that occur and deaths that occur. So it's still possible, but it is largely under control.
Mm-hmm.
In other parts of the world, it's not the case. And so, this is all a great reminder of why it is important to get your dog a rabies vaccine and to also get yourself immunized if you come into contact with the disease.
Right. And that time is very important there.
Right. Yeah. So the incubation period for rabies is typically 2 to 3 months, but may vary from 1 week to a year. And I think it depends on like the viral load and being introduced into your body and some other factors.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are two forms of the disease that are possible in humans. So once, this virus is in your system, one version is paralytic rabies. This only occurs in about 20% of cases, and it consists of gradual muscle paralyzation, coma, and death. It's often misdiagnosed, but again, like 20% of cases, this is what occurs. The other, however, is the incarnation of rabies that certainly brings to mind these ideas of strange curses from the gods, the really horrible stuff, and that's furious rabies. Symptoms here include hyperactivity, excitable behavior, hydrophobia, the fear of water, and sometimes aerophobia as well, fear of drafts of fresh air or, blasts of air, that sort of thing. Mm. And death occurs in these cases within a few days due to cardiac arrest.
Now, I got to admit, I've always heard rabies described as or associated with this idea of hydrophobia, which obviously, yeah, that means fear of water. But I never knew exactly what to make of that. Like, what does that mean in practice?
Yeah, because it's, you know, when you start thinking about like the things that a viral infection does, like, you know, to what extent is it about prolonging that virus or you know, achieving something in its you know, in its cycle, and as you look into it, it's really quite interesting. So again, this is a really horrible fate, the furious rabies. If one comes down with this, a person's behavior and mood is drastically altered. Anxiety, hallucinations, confusion, paranoia, terror, and they tend to experience both a profound thirst and a severe inability to quench that thirst. So what does all this mean? Well, keep in mind that saliva is central to rabies transmission. You know, if you think of, if you just hear the words rabid dog, the image that probably comes to mind is that of a dog frothing at the mouth, right, with frothing saliva.
Right, and it's generally understood that, I guess, the saliva is what transmits the disease. Like, if you are bitten by a dog that has rabies or by an animal that has rabies, the saliva will transmit it to your blood. Is that a real route of transmission?
Yes, that is the primary route of transmission. Yeah. Bites and scratches are the most common ways that it is just transmitted. There are other ways, you know, basically any infected fluid could do it. But those are uncommon compared to bites and scratches, especially when you're, you know, think of a dog, think of even, you know, a bat or any other organism that would carry rabies. The bite is the thing. And it's steered in these cases by, you know, enhanced aggression and altered behavior. And seemingly, you know, the mouth is primed to transmit the virus by excess infectious frothing saliva.
Okay, so much in the same way that respiratory viruses that are spread by aerosols or droplets might tend to cause the infected person to cough or sneeze in order to further spread themselves to other people, this disease that is spread often by saliva into blood through bites, it would tend to cause the infected animal to froth in the mouth with a lot of infectious saliva and to be irritable or aggressive in ways that would lead to biting.
Right. And that brings us back to this question of hydrophobia. Like, then for what reason, you know, seemingly, like, what role does the fear and does this terror at the idea of water have to do with anything? So in humans, this appears to manifest as a kind of panic that sets in when presented with water, and difficulty in or inability to drink, like attempts to drink, may result in spasms. There is some clinical footage you can find online of individuals that have been diagnosed with rabies attempting to drink water. And I do not, it's very disturbing footage, so I don't recommend seeking it out. But if you find yourself in need of the visuals for this, there is some documentation online. I believe a case in Vietnam is typically cited here.
Now, does the difficulty with drinking water when someone is infected with rabies usually have something to do with difficulty in muscle control for like swallowing through neurological routes?
Yes, yes, definitely so. And the insidious nature of all this, though, is that since the individual is prohibited from drinking water by the infection, or at least the drinking water becomes excruciatingly difficult, saliva production increases, you have hypersalivation, and they can't swallow the excess saliva, and they can't wash away this excess frothing saliva. So in other words, it primes the victim's mouth to be this potent transmitter of the virus, especially through a bite. So it's, it has a real insidious quality to it.
But as horrible as rabies is, again, fortunately, there are vaccines that exist.
Right, yes. So again, all a great reminder, yeah, get your pet vaccinated for rabies. And if you come into contact with an animal that has rabies or may have had rabies, you definitely need to go to a doctor. They can take care of it. You don't want this. This is not an illness you want running its course. Yeah.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride.
Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Eugene Fodor!
Gene, was booted!
Much of the joy you will find on the road comes from the person you share it with.
So you ride the books, Gene. Last hour on the business. I understand now. It's a wise man who marries a wiser woman.
But be careful and choose your travel partner well, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
Get down!
I'm not stupid, Gene. Something is going on, and it's high time you tell me the truth.
Freeze, Americano!
Gene, run!
So travel before it's too late. Your money will return. Your time won't. And we're all too quickly approaching that final destination.
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you want to level up your marketing and business knowledge, then look no further than the Marketing School podcast hosted by Neil Patel and yours truly, Eric Hsu. It is the number one marketing podcast in the United States and number 15 on business in the United States. And it has amazing guests such as Alex Hormozi, Layla Hormozi, Cody Sanchez. We pull in these amazing interviews with other people that are not only great marketers, but actual operators. And the icing on the cake is Neil and myself were also operators as well. So we share learnings from the trenches. We share secrets that we otherwise wouldn't be sharing with other people. And we also share other advantages that will help you get ahead of your competition. So all you have to do is listen to Marketing School every weekday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, I wanted to share another example, though, that seems to go or potentially goes in the opposite direction. Rabies inhibits thirst and alters thirst in that direction. But if we look to the world of the horsehair worm, we see something that may possibly be involved in generating excessive thirst in the host.
Hmm.
So this would have to do with parasitoid worms from the phylum Nematomorpha. They're known as horsehair worms because they're thread-like round worms that resemble the hair of a horse's tail or mane. Now, some of you may have seen these before. These are creatures that you'll sometimes find living free in a puddle or stream. I think I saw one once like this while walking on my mom's property. Mm-hmm. But you can also see them occasionally burst out of the body of a cricket, mantis, beetle, or other host organism, very much like a xenomorph.
Oh, now, maybe I was seeing something else, but I know I've seen video of something that was like a long, thin worm that was just gradually spooling out of a cricket's exoskeleton and it just kept spooling. Yep. And spooling and spooling, almost like the clown car where, you know, 50 clowns get out of a Volkswagen, but it's a worm that seems bigger than the cricket it was inside.
Yes, and it's crazy to watch. I have a very vivid memory of being in a junior high band environment, and there was a cricket on the floor. And somebody in a neighboring section was grossed out by the presence of the cricket. And so they stomped it. And then once they had stomped the cricket, this horsehair worm began emerging from the cricket, which of course only further grossed out the individual who'd stomped the cricket. So there's some sort of weird, horrific justice in that. Like, if you think the cricket's gross, well, just wait till you see what the encore is.
Surely it helped that in band practice that day you were playing Carmina Burana.
Yeah, if only. So the interesting thing here is that the adults of this species and these organisms, they are free living in the water, but the larvae are parasitic and grow to adulthood inside the body of an insect. So I think you can all imagine how this probably goes down. Male and female horsehair worms mate in damp soil and fresh water, and then the female lays millions of eggs. These eggs hatch, and the tiny larvae insist on vegetation near the water's edge. And then what happens? Well, a cricket or some other suitable host drops by. It ends up eating that larva one way or another. Either a cricket is eating the grass, or like a mantis is going to eat the larva itself. And so what happens then is a cricket comes along and it eats the grass that has this larva on it. Or if it's a carnivorous mantis, well, then it eats a cricket that has already been infected by the larva. In either case, the larva winds up inside of another organism. The cyst dissolves, and then the juvenile worm escapes, bores through the gut wall, and starts absorbing nutrients from the host organism.
This worm has a move fast and break things philosophy. It is a disruptor of the internal organs of its host.
Right. And at this point, it's kind of like you can imagine it like a stowaway in the hold of a ship. You know, it's rummaging around. It's eating some of the stored food supplies, maybe eating the occasional crew member on that ship, and otherwise also damaging the ship. But it doesn't need, if you're a stowaway, a human stowaway on a ship, what do you want to do? You want to get to a port somewhere, right? Right. And likewise with this worm, it needs to get to water or damp soil in order to continue its life cycle. Now, if something happens to the cricket, if it gets stomped in on the floor of a middle school band room, it's going to escape. It's going to abandon ship, but it needs to get to damp soil or fresh water.
So it may be moving fast and breaking things, but it's going to try to do so in such a way that it ends up at a certain place when the whole thing goes kaput.
Right. It needs to steer the host in the right direction. And so this is where we get that bit of parasitic hijacking in action. Or at least that's one hypothesis of exactly what's going on, that the worm instills a crazed thirst in the host so that it seeks out water. That's sometimes referred to as the thirst hypothesis. Mm-hmm. An alternate hypothesis states that the worm simply waits till the host finds water on its own, and then it jumps out. And it's my understanding that we're really not 100% sure what happens. Though there's some interesting evidence for both hypotheses. Ed Yong in a 2014 TED Talk mentioned that there's research that indicates that this may occur because the organism releases proteins that alter the cricket's brain functionality. There does seem to be some sort of it seems like there is a strong case to be made that some sort of hijacking is taking place. And if that's occurring, it may be pushing the animal towards water via thirst.
Okay, so I guess that would mean you might be able to notice this if you had a place where a bunch of insects were getting infected by this parasite. They would be showing a lot of drinking behavior, a lot of water drinking behavior.
Right. But then again, yeah, there's also the other argument. Well, it's waiting until it's drinking. Even that though would be pretty impressive, because it's that, like, how does the worm know what's going on inside the darkness of the cricket or the darkness of the mantis that enables the stowaway to know that there is water or damp soil close at hand. Mm-hmm. But I was looking at some of the papers that discuss this. This is a much older paper now, but there was a 2001 study published in the German journal Zoologische Anzeiger that says that the thirst hypothesis has been supported by observations of quote-unquote suicidal behavior by infected mantises in southern France that would seemingly jump into the water and then immediately out comes the worm. So that would be a case where, yeah, like it, the mantis is not just going to the water; it is the, to drink, and then it bursts out. It's actually jumping in. It's giving up the ghost. But I guess with that, you still would have to ask your question: at what point is there a hijacking of behavior? Was it the seeking the water to begin with, or was it something that kicked in when the creature was close to water?
Mm.
So we're not sure exactly, you know, which way to go on this, as far as I understand, based on the research I was looking at. But it seems like either way, you're getting into these interesting, you're getting into the relationship between the host organism and water. You know, something about its bodily awareness of water, or the thirst or desire to be in close proximity to water, and of course, that is ultimately what the parasite wants as well.
Right. So the parasite either needs a mechanism of making the host go drink water or knowing when the host is drinking water.
Right. Oh, and in case anybody's worried, it's my understanding that occasionally humans end up ingesting these things, but I don't think there's ever been any evidence or anything to support the idea that they're capable of hijacking human behavior. Again, if that is indeed what's happening in the case of crickets and mantises.
Well, what happens when humans do ingest them?
It's just kind of gross. They like vomit them up. I was looking, there were two Japanese cases reported in 2012, due to the accidental ingestion of infected insects. I think in these cases, this has occurred via the consumption of vegetables that had those encysted larvae on them.
You ever notice some vegetables seem like they'd be a lot better at hiding little stowaways than others? I have this consistent problem with broccoli. I love broccoli. I love cooking with it. But a number of times I've been like giving it a rinse before I cook it or something. And then I'm like, oh, there's just a bug up in the tree limbs there. It's hiding out in a little fork in the florets.
That's true. I mean, it's kind of the thing about broccoli, right? Is that the thing that makes it so delicious, that's it's so great to cook, because you get all the oil or the seasoning, it ends up just getting embedded there in all the little nooks and crannies. It also means there are all these additional places that I guess something could potentially hide, or you could just end up with some dirt or grit in there.
Maybe I'm just getting my broccoli from really buggy sources. It's been like, I don't know. Sometimes I get like CSA broccoli. That's it's really nice, good stuff. But there's just a big old bug in there.
Just like tarantulas crawling out of it through your kitchen and stuff.
Almost.
I mean, it's all just a good reminder. Wash your vegetables, everybody. If you're not sure they need it, you know, give them a once over. Why not?
Right.
You'll feel better about it, especially if you're listening to this episode whilst cooking. All right, we're going to go ahead and close out Thirst Part 3. What do you think, Joe? Do you think we'll be back with Thirst 4: Thirst for Knowledge?
The return of Jack Thirst?
Yes.
Yes. Yes, we will be back. I'm sure of it.
Yeah? Like this Thursday back?
This Thursday back, yes.
This Thursday, Thirst Part 4, Thirst for More Knowledge. The final chapter, only on Stuff to Blow Your Mind. Or some other topic. I don't know. We'll see how it goes. All right. In the meantime, if you would like to check out other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, you know where to find them. They're in the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast feed every Tuesday and Thursday. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts. You can also go to stufftoblowyourmind.com, and that will shoot you over to the iHeart listing for this show. I think there is a link to our t-shirt store there if you just want to pick up some sort of Stuff to Blow Your Mind related design on a shirt or a sticker. We actually have we may be getting some new ones in the weeks and months ahead. And I know there are some designs by listeners that I've added in recent months. So there's a Leshy t-shirt in there. There's a kind of psychedelic looking mushroom in there. And let's see, what's the other one? Oh yeah, there's the Pandora's Box shirt. Those are all wonderful designs. So check those out if you want to. They're pretty fun. And let's see what else. Oh yeah, Tuesday and Thursday core episodes, Wednesday's Artifact, Monday's Listener Mail, Friday is Weird House Cinema. That's our time to set aside most serious matters and just talk about a strange film.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Gene Fodor!
Gene, what's good?
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano!
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you want to level up your marketing and business knowledge, look no further than the Marketing School podcast, hosted by Neil Patel and yours truly, Eric Su. It is the number one marketing podcast on Apple and number 15 on business in the United States. Now, if you want to listen to interesting conversations with operators that have been there, done that, also with other interesting guests, then listen to Marketing School every weekday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.